This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with the IU Northwest Dean of Students, Beth Tyler, about the Gary campus's sexual assault prevention programs. It's part of the many programs that they have on the Gary campus, helping students deal with their issues, not only as students, but also as citizens of the Northwest Indiana community. We'll check with Ann Massey, who is the president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council, on how well this year's Farm Hop tours went and what's ahead for the organization. And also, we'll hear from Gerard McClendon and his guests from Lakeshore Public Television program, the topic this time, cyberbullying. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. With the fall semester underway at IU Northwest in Gary, the campus wants to make sure that students understand how important it is to recognize and prevent sexual misconduct. And this includes domestic and dating violence, as well as sexual harassment and stalking. And it's very important because the month of October is National Domestic Violence and Abuse Awareness Month. And we're covering through another topic now. This time we're talking about the IU Northwest campus. And with us to talk about it, we have the Dean of Students, Beth Tyler, with us. Dean Tyler, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris, for having me. I'm very happy to be here today.
Will you take a few minutes here and tell us a little bit about the uniqueness that the Gary campus in particular has, and maybe there's some relationship to some of the other campuses within the IU system, but how unique that IU Northwest is compared to, we'll say, Bloomington, where there are a lot of residence halls and a lot of students who live on campus, go to classes, come back to their dorms, residence halls, and in turn, what is, makes up their life. We have a lot of students at Gary campus. They live in the community, whatever community it may happen to be that they happen to live in. They come to campus for their classes and interact with students here, too, and it's a little different at IU Northwest compared to many of the other campuses in the system.
That's true, Chris. So essentially, when we're looking at prevention and awareness around sexual misconduct and sexual violence, we want to look at what are the particular challenges that our students face and what are our goals in doing programs around these kinds of issues for our students. And at a residential campus, any residential campus, a lot of what they're looking at is how to reduce instances of sexual misconduct on campus, right? That tends to be the number that they're looking at. They're also looking at general awareness around the issue. But when you're at a commuter campus where students do not live here, a lot of the experiences that they're having around sexual misconduct are happening in their lives and not here on campus. So the challenge for us is, what kind of outcomes are we looking for with our students to make sure that we are doing whatever we can to help them avoid situations in their lives and in the community that might cause them to confront any kind of sexual misconduct? How can we increase their awareness about what they can do to help themselves and others avoid issues? But also to understand that we, as an educational institution and as their home campus, want to be able to help them address any issues that they have and help ameliorate any problems that persist in their lives, and especially those that might affect their education as a result of any kind of bad experiences they've had, either prior to coming here or after coming here.
I know that even during this month of October, there have been a number of programs that have been already initiated by the Office of Student Activities, taking the lead on many of these and helping in educating and making people aware of the problems of students being involved with dating violence, as well as with other types of domestic violence they may encounter in their lives. Tell us about how some of these programs, these discussions have happened so far to kind of enlighten people if they're not aware of it.
Well, we have something called Sex Signals on Campus, which is an interactive performance between two people on stage. And what they do is sort of enact various relationship scenarios and invite the audience to kind of comment on what they see occurring on stage, right? And so if there's a man and a woman interacting on stage and maybe they don't know each other, and the performers play out scenarios and invite the audience to kind of hold up a sign, is what they did, to say stop, when they saw the behavior of one of the other people getting to a place that was bordering on inappropriate or even illegal, right? So because sexual harassment is basically unwanted contact, and it's very important to understand the cues so that the person who might be about to perpetrate bad behavior kind of is aware, but also that the person who is perhaps being the recipient of unwanted contact knows enough to say that that's not appropriate and that they don't want it. So in many ways, what we're trying to get students to do is be more confident and comfortable speaking out about their own needs and desires and what their boundaries are. We also had a great panel, and this is a very indirect way of looking at prevention. We had a panel of people whose work in the community is involved in responding to any kind of sexual, mostly sexual assault and sexual violence, and how we and what the process is that happens when a student reports an incident of sexual assault, perhaps. We had a SANE nurse, which is a sexual assault nurse examiner, a prosecutor, a rape crisis counselor, somebody who represents minorities and LGBT people, and a detective, because one of the biggest problems with reducing sexual assault and sexual violence in our communities is that people who are victims or survivors don't come forward. And some of the reasons that they don't come forward is because they don't have faith in the process or they don't understand what's going to happen. So we had a great panel discussion with those people talking about what happens and talking about what's supposed to happen. Because if we can increase the confidence of people who might report an incident, we are more likely to have some sort of an accountability on the part of any perpetrator. And then we also had a speaker, Byron Hurt, who is a national figure. He's actually, I think, worked internationally. He's an anti-sexist activist and a filmmaker, and he did a talk called Locker Room Talk or Toxic Masculinity, and he was looking at the ways in which men and boys are socialized that might contribute toward male violence against women, and to sort of increase awareness among our students and faculty and staff who are in the audience about the ways in which we can prevent that by being engaged bystanders and trying to affect the way we perceive one another's behavior.
I know one of the other projects that has just been finished up here is a well-known one. It's been on campus for over a number of years, the Clothesline Project. Explain
That's
that,
right.
If you will, explain that to our listeners and what came out of, at least from this year's events.
Well, the Clothesline Project is also a national event, and I couldn't even tell you how long it's been around in the country, but this was our fifth year doing it. It's sponsored by, it's a collaborative effort across campus, but primarily sponsored by our Women and Gender Studies program. And the Clothesline Project, it's basically using the idea of the clothesline as a space where women gather to share stories and information about their lives. But what this particular project does is invite people to design T-shirts that speak to either their own experiences of being victims of domestic violence or any sort of sexual violence, and sort of to have a cathartic opportunity to express themselves on the T-shirt. And then we display the T-shirts. It's actually on campus right now in our Moraine Center, on display for all to see, to sort of show the extent to which this issue touches our community. And it's not just women who do the shirts. It's people all over campus. And it's not just people who have been victims or who are survivors, but also allies who want to weigh in and sort of give their own point of view about what message they want to share with the community about how we can all be more aware about sexual and domestic violence.
We're talking with IU Northwest Dean of Students Beth Tyler about the issues of domestic violence, dating violence as well, because we're talking about young people of college age in many cases, as well as the other issues that come about involving the interaction of men and women and other people on campus and off campus, too, because this is one of the important things that since IU Northwest is a commuter campus, a lot of people, as we mentioned at the start of our conversation, bring their problems they may happen to encounter from home or from wherever they happen to live onto campus when they come in for classes and the like. Dean Tyler, I know last year the students got a chance to participate in what is called the Community Activities and Experiences with Sexual Assault Survey. It's a very long survey, and I know there are a lot of different parts and pieces to that, but if you will, give us a highlight of some of the things that you've probably no doubt gone through and looking at the results of it and what you've learned and what you think that IU Northwest officials can do to help students deal with some of these problems.
Sure. We abbreviate that, Chris. We call it the Campus Climate Survey, and it's something that was done at every IU campus over the past year or so. And the goal was really to try to get a sense of what kinds of issues our students are facing, both before they came to IU Northwest and since they have come here. And what we have found, and what we already kind of knew from basically reporting on campus, is that the students tend to be experiencing much more off campus than on. And the particular challenges that we face that we think that we can assist with are, first of all, increasing students' awareness about the policies and procedures that we have on campus to help them if they do have an incident off campus. Even if it didn't happen on campus, we can often help them think about what their options are or to make sure that whatever experience they have doesn't have a negative influence on their academic work. So we're very interested in increasing awareness around what we can do to help them. We also learned that our students tend to have more experiences with sexual harassment in their lives, and I think it's often student-on-student sexual harassment, and again, that comes to the question of being comfortable saying what is and is not something, a behavior that you want someone to kind of, how you want to be interacted with in the world, and then to make clear to others that you don't want that, and that our students often are having issues at home with domestic and dating violence, right? So we want to do more programming around healthy relationships, informing our students about what sexual harassment is, what they can do to lessen it in their lives, and what we can do and what we want to do to help them if it happens. I think we also have some evidence that, and this is not uncommon in the world today with social media and phones everywhere, that cyber stalking and harassment using those devices is something that our students experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got some surprising information about their lack of understanding about consent or their lack of tendency to discuss issues of consent with their partners and in their communities, right? Because so often when somebody ends up in my office, of course that doesn't really happen on our campus, but in a dean's office or in a court because of any sort of an allegation of a sexual misconduct,
right,
is often an issue of consent involved.
Mm-hmm. The university system has what is called the IU Student Welfare Initiative. Will you take a minute to explain what that is and then how IU Northwest participates as one of the campuses in the system?
Sure. The Student Welfare Initiative is a university-wide initiative, and it's basically we have a student welfare officer who's based in Bloomington, and she has a staff, and we all work very closely with her. The initiative is really, the purpose is to coordinate and intensify efforts across all campuses to prevent and respond to assault and any other forms of sexual misconduct. So there are a number of committees that meet. We have a prevention and education committee that I sit on, and we have essentially a conference every month via phone, and then we usually get together at least once a year for various conferences and workshops where we talk about what our various challenges are on our campus. We learn best practices from one another so that we are doing the best that we can to both prevent and educate our students about how they can prevent sexual misconduct on campus. And they provide really great workshops. And one of the things we're working on this year is a strategic plan here at IU Northwest so that we can make sure to bring our resources to bear in the most effective and efficient ways to address the particular challenges that our students face. And Indiana University has been really helpful in providing resources for us to think about the best way to approach this strategic planning process. And so we have a task force that is working on that strategic plan that has people from all over the IU Northwest campus on it, staff and faculty and also students, to talk about how we can make sure to tailor our particular programming toward our students and toward our challenges.
Now, finally, Dean Tyler, I'd like to find out a little bit about the efforts that are being made. We talk here so far a lot of things that happen sort of top down, from the leadership down through the ranks, so to speak, faculty and staff, to the students. What are the students trying to do on their own, and you're trying to assist them as the Dean of Students to help get organization in some of the concerns that they may have and create more ongoing programs that will be awareness programs, enlightening people about domestic and dating violence and the other problems?
Well, we have a very active student government, and our student government president and one other student sits on our task force, and they really are invaluable to us because we cannot really reach the broader student body with students assisting us. And so I'm right now working with the president of student government to put together an interest group of other students on campus who have identified themselves over the past year or so as being interested in these issues so that we can put together a student organization that actually has an administrative structure, an advisor, which may very well be me. We haven't gotten to that stage yet. Mm-hmm. And they're interested in doing some programming they're focusing on the programming for next spring that will probably largely revolve around healthy relationships and consent. And by creating a student organization, we want to try, so often student activism ebbs and flows on the basis of individual student interests. But by creating an actual registered student organization, we can create that structure that's needed to continue from year to year so that there can be an actual ongoing programming practice. And so I'm working pretty closely with students to try to get the word out to other students so that we can be sure to program according to what they think will be effective. I have lots of ideas, but I'm not always, as a sort of middle-aged administrator, even though I'm pretty plugged into students, I don't always know exactly the right way to reach them.
That's true. You have to work with the students and get their ideas, and this way they probably feel more comfortable. I'm more confident in talking with you about
Absolutely.
The issues. Yeah, that's true. We've been talking with IU Northwest Dean of Students, Beth Tyler. It's not just the month of October that should be an awareness month for the issues involving domestic violence, domestic abuse, date violence, and the like. Should happen year-round, and that's what some of these initiatives being put to force on the campus in Gary is. Dean, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate your comments, and we hope to have you back.
Thank you very much, Chris. We're really happy to be here.
Let's check in and see how this year's Farm Hop series of tours across Northwest Indiana went. We'll have a chance to find out how urban farmers and other farmers have been able to explain to the public what they do for a living and sometimes their passion in life as well. And for that, we're turning to Ann Massey. She's the president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council. Ann, thank you once again for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us first, how did things go on this year's Farm Hop event?
Oh, it was fantastic. We could not have been happier with how the day went on all four tours. We had just over 100 people come out that day for the four tours around Northwest Indiana. And so far, the feedback has been great. We're going through all of our surveys, and it looks like 100% of people said they would do it again. So we plan on doing it next year with a little change-up of separating out the tours so farmers and guests can actually go on more than one tour next year.
That's great. I know, I'm sure with such a wide variety of farms that were available to be looked at out there, and I'm sure there are a lot of people that wanted to do a nice mix of urban as well as rural or semi-rural farms. This way you give them an opportunity to really enjoy themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. We were pleasantly surprised to hear that there was that much interest, and we'll keep rolling with that.
That's great. One of the events coming up here very near future is what is being called the Up Up Farm Film Festival. And tell us about what that's all about. It's an interesting screening of a film I think people ought to check out.
Yes. It's this Friday, October 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. We'll be at the Indiana Welcome Center right there off of Kennedy in Hammond. Mm-hmm. The Northwest Indiana Food Council and the Hoosier Young Farmers Coalition, we've teamed up to do an 8-minute sneak peek into the grassroots work on urban farming and democratizing access to affordable, nutritious food with a film called Planting Justice. It's a casual event. It's family-friendly. We'll be looping pieces of the film throughout the evening so you can come in and chat. We're expecting quite a few people from the Hoosier Young Farmers Coalition. They're all beginning farmers or early farmers. So there'll be a really neat crowd there to get to network with.
That's great. Now, give us an idea, if you will, a little bit about this, about Planting Justice. How long in the works had this been in planting and getting things together for the presentation that's coming up?
Absolutely. The film is part of the Hoosier Young Farmers Coalition statewide film festival. They've been showing films throughout the state all year long that have to do with issues in farming, both rural and urban. And we felt that showing a film about urban farming in our area would be appropriate and great conversation since so much good work is happening in the urban areas of our region.
Now, you talk about the opportunity to be able to meet some of these local farmers and the food producers. So I guess this comes together and I guess what you could call a local food celebration, doesn't it?
Yes, I would definitely call it that. It's a way to bring farmers together and have fun. Here at the Northwest Indiana Food Council, we're all about being relaxed, having fun, building this network from the ground up. So a lot of it has to do with just making those connections and having conversations.
We're talking with Ann Massey, who is the president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council, about some of the events coming up here that involve food and urban farming and the farmers that come here in Northwest Indiana to put together the great food that you can pick up not only at their own places but also available elsewhere, too. One of the events coming up, too, we should talk about very soon in November is the Farm to Table Festival. Tell us about that. That's going to be held, by the way, at the Country Line Orchards in Lake and Porter Counties.
Yes, this will be the seventh year that the Farm to Table Festival has been going on. It started as a way to showcase and celebrate all the food created in our region, especially those created by urban farms, grown by urban farms in the Gary, East Chicago, Portage regions. It's usually about $40 for a ticket. It's family friendly. It's pretty much all you can eat, all you can drink. There's going to be beer tastings from about a dozen local breweries. There will be upwards of 6 to 8 different restaurants and chefs represented. And the team that puts this together works really hard to source every ingredient as locally as possible, down to the seasonings, the butters, the oils, all of that.
Do you think that some of the participants in the upcoming Farm to Table Festival might be some of the farms and other organizations that were involved in Farm Hop this year?
Definitely. We are working with some of the farms that were on a couple of the tours who will be supplying ingredients for different dishes that evening. And pretty much, usually the farmers come too to enjoy the evening and eat good food and drink delicious beer.
That's right. Now that's coming up on November 4th, by the way. If anybody is interested in getting the tickets, how can they do that?
You can find them on County Line Orchard's website. They also should be available through their Facebook.
All right. Also, the Northwest Indiana Food Council has their final big meeting of the year coming up later in November, in fact, November 29th, and that's going to be happening in La Porte. Tell us more about that, if you will, Ann, and what you hope that that people will take advantage of if they come over to La Porte for the meeting.
Sure. We've had our series of meetups throughout the year. It's just a way for people to get together, connect about their local food projects. Some people who don't have projects going on who just want to know what's happening around the region. This is a casual way to meet over food or a beer if we happen to be at a brewery and talk in a relaxed environment. The PAC Center is a really interesting and important place in our region. It's a community kitchen that serves the La Porte area. And I encourage anyone who's interested in a volunteering opportunity to come out that night just to see what the PAC Center is all about. But we will also be there enjoying the meal that evening and getting to talk with people about local food projects in our region.
Now, I know we've talked here about the events bringing us up here towards the end of the year, but I'm sure you and other folks there with the Northwest Indiana Food Council have been looking ahead to 2018. Any ideas about what, besides the things like Farm Hop, are going to be on the schedule for 2018 as yet?
Yes, we will be doing the Farm Hop again, just revamping it a little bit so that people can go on multiple tours and you don't have to choose. Mm-hmm. And we will also have our food expo and discussion, we call FED, in early March or late February. And we'll have that date out here in the next week or two.
That's great. Some great things to check on. And here again, give the website so people can keep an eye on what is coming up with the Northwest Indiana Food Council, please.
And feel free to subscribe to our email list. That's the best way to keep up to date on our events.
Mm-hmm.
It is www.nwifoodcouncil.org.
Ann Massey is the president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council. As always, thanks for being with us to talk about these events ahead. And glad to hear that Farm Hop 2017 was such a success. And we're looking forward to the same thing in this next year as well, too. And we hope that you have a great holiday ahead and hope to be talking to you again soon.
Thanks so much for your time, Chris.
Is cyberbullying a real crime? Well, that's the topic of this Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon on Lakeshore Public Television. Gerard's guests talking about it are Kathy Bledsoe of the Indiana State Police, Bob Heiss with the Times of Northwest Indiana, and he's also a member of an initiative called Civility Counts, and a school town of Highland Superintendent Brian Smith. Here's the conversation.
We're in the age of rapid internet. You know, Wi-Fi connections and Ethernet connections are unbelievable now. Gone are the days of the modems that made noise and it took 10 minutes to download a picture. Those days are over. We've got streaming video now. And as nice as these things are and as positive if we can do positive things on the internet, we also find that people do some very negative things on the internet. Let's start by looking at Indiana law. It defines bullying as unwanted, repeated acts, including digitally and electronically transmitted communications, as well as physical aggression and other behaviors, intended to harass, ridicule, humiliate, intimidate, or harm the targeted student. Now, it also states that Indiana does not have a specific law against cyberbullying. So even though we have all of these nouns, verbs, and adjectives that state that bullying is a bad thing, sometimes it's hard to pinpoint when it comes to the speech. First thing out, is cyberbullying, is it a real crime or just an inconvenience? Kathy Bledsoe, what... I got to start with you here because you deal with youth.
Yes.
Educating youth.
First thing I'd like to point out is we do not have a cyberbully law, but we do have three statutes related to cyber harassment, computer trespass, and internet intimidation. So we in Indiana are actually being very proactive when it comes to this. We do look at it as a crime. Mm-hmm. I spent years working in Allen County Juvenile Center, and we had students who were brought in on those statutes because they had violated using technology that the school provided, and the school was able to enforce those statutes on those students.
What's a cyber trespass?
Basically, it's identity theft, creating accounts and causing harm to... And actually, the statute says if they cause a certain number of harm financially, I want to say it's something like $10,000 or $50,000, and if it reaches at least 100 people. So if at least 100, which is easy on the internet, if at least 100 people are going to see this false information, then it can be processed for cyber harassment.
Oh, wow. So something's put out falsely on you. Now it becomes a crime. I want to go to you, Brian Smith. You're a superintendent. We understand that certain things are protected by the First Amendment. But as Kathy mentioned, when it comes to schools, how does a superintendent, a principal, a teacher, how do you deal with that somewhat ghost-like ethereal aspect of students using the internet in a way that's negative, but how do you police that? What do you do?
Great question. It's very difficult to police that in today's society with all the different options that students have. Usually, we can, by law, take care of or work with the internet bullying when it becomes a distraction in our schools. So that's the big word is distraction. When it becomes an issue in the school, it's a distraction. Then we can work with it, and at that point we can investigate, do a whole plethora of different things to address depending on the severity of the cyberbullying that's happening.
So I'm glad you brought that up. Distraction or disruption, even though it may be something that takes place outside of the school, if it's distracting or disrupting my school building, I can go after that student in terms of that student being disciplined. A student or a parent just can't say, well, this is something that he did on his computer at home and it trickled into the school. That's not an excuse, Mr. Smith?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to say, but we find that in many cases that hostility that's online doesn't stay there. Mm. Once it's in the school, one of the biggest problems with cyber harassment online is that everyone in the school knows it. Mm. So you started this environment of hate and hostility that the student now has to try to walk through. So the chances of it actually becoming a real world physical problem for the school grows.
And it happens instantly. You know, it's very quick. Everybody has a phone. Everybody knows without even having a conversation.
You know, it's funny because when you juice up your phone with all the apps, all the social media content, as well as putting alerts on your phone for all, the phone will buzz all day, you know, and you can set it to have alerts for certain people. You can set it to filter certain people as well. But I want to stay with you, Bob, because why does civility count? Why does it even count? Why is it even important in a world that sometimes embraces uncivilized practices? And that's what this is. I mean, when you're harassing on the internet, that's an uncivilized practice. So why does civility count?
Well, if you get to the heart of civility counts, which is we started this campaign 2 years ago, but it's treating someone the way you want to be treated. And, you know, we're not communicating the way we used to. And, you know, we're not picking up the phone and talking. We're not interpersonal. It's all this other stuff that we're describing. But the heart of it is, do you want to be treated that way? No, you don't. Mm. And so we, in our campaign, we started an anti-bullying initiative to bring out good practices and get people thinking about how they can better a school environment, better treating each other.
Mm.
And it really does count, and if you get it when you're young, you're going to keep it and grow it as an adult.
So you got to get to them young. You got to get to the young people.
It's helpful.
Yeah.
It's helpful. I think it has to start at a community and then get to a national level eventually. Obviously, the campaign showed the national level needs a lot of help.
So this fast internet, it provides a veil of anonymity. I can be whoever I want on the internet. People have keyboard courage, right? They wouldn't do this or say it in front of a person, but they've got a smartphone, they've got a tablet, they click something, say something insulting, and they get a few likes, get a few hits, get a few comments, and they're happy. They would never say it to that person in their face. So, is there a way to stop this? I'm going to you, Kathy. Is there a way to stop this? Do we do it in a punitive fashion? Do we do it by modeling good behavior? Some people don't want good behavior modeled. What do we do with this?
Well, I think one thing is we're making this problem like it's a small thing. We talk about how it affects schools and students in school, but we forget the worldwide impact. You can post something online, and it could have started out as a beef between two kids at school, but the people who comment may have nothing to do with the school, may not even be in the city, state, or country for that matter. Mm. There's lots of cases, very infamous cases, the Amanda Todd case. She was in Canada, harassed literally by people all over the world. Her original harasser was in the Netherlands. Mm. She eventually killed herself. The other thing that people seem to forget about this is once you post it online, it's there. So if I was cyber harassed online and I just do a Google search with my name, I may see all this hatred and all this evil still there, and it's been 5 years since I've left school or 20 years. Yeah. If you search someone like Amanda Todd, you can still find the horrible posts that were written about her while she was still alive. And the girl's been dead for 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So we need to look at the massive impact that everything on the internet has. And the first thing we try to do, this is why the Indiana State Police started this initiative of hiring youth educators to go into the school, is education. Get the kids to understand that this is a problem. Not only does it affect the person you are bullying, but this is now linked to you. When you go for a job interview, I can search you and see that you are a bully. I don't want you to be a greeter at my Walmart if you can't be civil to people.
Right, right.
So you are impacting your entire future with this kind of behavior.
I'm glad you brought up that case, because there's also a case in Texas. Brandy Vella,
yes,
commits suicide in front of family, yes, after the prolonged cyber bullying. And I'm coming to you, Brian, with schools. Brandy says in a message to her family, "I love you so much. Just remember that, please, and I'm so sorry for everything." Her family said the harassment focused mainly on Brandy's weight. They would make dating websites about Brandy that were totally untrue, and they would put her number, telephone number up, and they would put her picture up and lie about her age and say that she would do precarious acts online and with anyone. And she takes her life, and we think about the children. You know, Brian, it's tough being a superintendent. It's tough being an administrator, because every day you're thinking about every child and every parent in your district. So how do all of the Highland schools get in front of this? How do you protect your students and your parents from a cyberbullying case to escalate?
It's a really tough question, because it's so difficult to keep from occurring and spreading fast. We work with our kids from elementary through middle school through high school. We have a very successful, it's called OVEAS, bullying program that does all types of bullying, not just cyberbullying, where we're working on character for students, character counts, and how important that is. So we try to attack it, all the students that we have. We also train every one of our employees. Part of a prereq to being hired at Highland is there's some videos you watch on bullying, and where you pick up what bullying really is,
yeah.
How bullying occurs, and you're picking up what when you see students, is that really bullying? Is that affecting students in a certain way? And then we'll throw resources, all resources we have possible.
Yeah.
Guidance, school resource officers, administrators, we'll get parents in, community.
Yeah. You know, Bob, when it comes to, I'm short on time in this first segment, but civility counts. We want to embrace that notion. We want to know that civility does count. To be a civil person, to be a good citizen, that counts. But we have this beautiful thing called the First Amendment. You know, freedom of speech, freedom to petition the government, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, you know, freedom to assemble, all right? So does civility counts sometimes breach freedom of speech? You know, so it's one thing to be civil, but it's another thing to have freedom to voice my concerns, even if it's at a person in an editorialized way.
But you can voice your concerns on an issue or whatever you want to do in a civil way. You do not have to call people names and threaten them and that kind of thing. And that's really where we are. So I think that's what we try to get that message out and get people to think about. Can I do this in a way that I can bring out the topic, the issue of my personal choice without interfering in someone else's?
So, Bob, can civility be defined?
There's a lot of definitions, but yeah. Really the way I define it is treating each other the way you want to be treated.
Do unto others. Cyberbullying a real crime or just an inconvenience? You're watching Counterpoint. Voice your opinion. 844-777-9311. And Gerard MC on Facebook and Twitter. Kathy Bledsoe, Bob Heiss, and Brian Smith join me to see if we can find humanity in humans. Isn't that interesting? Trying to find a humane quality in human beings. Let me just start by saying, should I ignore a cyber bully? Now, I know it's tough when you're an adolescent mm-hmm. because you feel that everything said that's good, complimentary, is the truth. And you feel insulted by every criticism that you get. And it doesn't change when we become mature adults either. But is there a time when I should ignore a cyber bully, or should I retaliate, or should I let the authorities know? Kathy, you just said, to talk to us.
Well, studies say that 70% of successful cyber bullies cases are handled when kids ignore. When I do my talks in schools, the first thing I tell them, if someone is bullying you, you block them, you record the information in case we do decide we need to prosecute, and you ignore them. The moment you respond, you're feeding that bully. You're encouraging them. Even something as simple as saying, stop it. Mm-hmm. I recently had a case, actually not that far from here, where a young girl was being cyberbullied, and the principal had stepped in. I had been at the school last year to speak to the students about this. Four of the other students, from my message, decided to try to be positive about the child that was being victimized. Well, the bully just took that as more fodder and attacked the other four.
It was fuel.
So instead of having one child being cyberbullied online, I now had five children being cyberbullied online. So even if you're a bystander, the most powerful thing you can do is shut up the bully.
Yeah.
If everyone blocks them, if no one responds, if you told me a bad joke and we didn't laugh, you wouldn't say it again.
No.
And that's the same way with the bully. If the bully says something mean and no one responds, they'll get the message, hey, that wasn't cool. Maybe I should try a different approach.
Yeah, you're right, Kathy. But let me ask you this, Bob. Civility counts. I want to keep coming back to what the premise is here. In a civility count situation, do you ignore the bully? Are there actions that a civility counts person, a civil person, should do to...
You can respond or whatever in a way that is the way you would want them to act and try that approach. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it'll work.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about if you ignore the bully, though, does the bully go to somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it time to address it right there?
Deflection, a form of deflection.
Yeah.
So I'm bullying Kathy. Kathy ignores me, and so I'm going to go to Pam.
Yeah, I wonder, does that happen?
But if you ignore them, record the information and report it, which there's a three-part to that, not just ignore. You ignore, report, and record. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to the principal of the school and saying, hey, this happened online. Just want to give you a heads up. I ignored them, but then the school can now act and bring in that child who was the bully online, mm-hmm. and provide them counseling, because sometimes it is because they're going through something. Or at least let them know, hey, we know this is, the light is on you now.
Yeah.
We're watching.
Brian, can a bully be suspended, expelled, given in school or out of school suspension for a cyber act?
Absolutely.
What
all of
might,
the above.
What might be a situation that would warrant that? So I'm online, and let's say I'm online today after school, and I'm clicking away, and I say some pretty terrible things about Bobby, all right? And I just keep going at him, and then it starts to affect the schooling of Bobby. When does this person with this keyboard courage, when do they get a suspension or an expulsion?
It depends on the severity. In a threat, for instance, they're gone. A threat, we're going to bring that person in. We're going to, in most cases, have a due process hearing and probably an expulsion when they're actually physically threatening another student in those situations.
And it doesn't have to happen more than once? So my question is, and to all three of you, actually, my question is, well, let's stick with schools.
Sure.
A threat is a threat, so we can't get beyond that. Mm-hmm. But if I'm teasing someone, and it's not a threat, if I'm teasing someone, is it cyberbullying if I do it once or twice, or is it cyberbullying when I do it 12 times? Is there some sort of a threshold of cyberbullying?
The definition of cyberbullying is that it has to be deliberate and repeated.
Repeated
is the important thing. You and me had a beef at school, and now I'm going to say something mean. But tomorrow I forgot.
Okay.
Or a week from now I stop. Okay, I've gotten over it. You've gotten over it. We're going to move forward. But now I'm targeting you every day, constantly. Mm. I am doing everything I can. And I'm not just targeting anybody. I'm targeting you.
Mm.
Then it's a threat.
So let's look at an image blast in your school. And I think you had another. Did you have another comment?
I was just going to say, based on what Kathy just said, exactly. It's repeated, and then it's progressive.
Right.
If we try to start with, we brought the child in. You've started this. It needs to stop now. It's having effects on this other child. Mm-hmm. It ends now. And then the student continues to do it. And then it gets progressive.
Mm-hmm.
Can lead to very serious consequences.
So, Bob, is civility even a real thing, or is it a concept or an ideal that is automatically to be adhered to and embraced?
It's an awareness. So you bring it, I think we have to understand that most people do have a civility piece to them.
Yeah.
I mean, we hear the extremes, the sound bites, the anonymous comments that are always the negative and all kinds. Most people are not in that. So there is that civility. So our idea is to make this, converse about it, bring it as an awareness thing, mm-hmm. and more people will think about it maybe the next time they act.
I would hope that we could get to a point. Well, middle schoolers are just mean. And
yes.
I'm being very prejudicial there. I used to be a middle schooler. Going through puberty. They don't quite understand themselves. They're getting acne. Certain body parts are starting to grow. It's just a weird time period, and everyone's trying to find their way. And when you're trying to find your way, sometimes you're not really thinking about what Bob says is civility. Sometimes you're not thinking about, as Brian would say, I'm in a school right now, don't care. Sometimes, you're not thinking about the great instruction that Kathy would give. You have an insecurity, and sometimes we project the insecurity on the others. Hurt people. Don't you just get a pass sometimes? Aren't we being a little sensitive, though?
No.
That's not, everything's not cyberbullying.
No, everything's not cyberbullying. Again, it has to be repeated and deliberate and progressive. And another thing that happens, we can make a mob mentality of hate, but we can also make a mob mentality of understanding and support. Mm. When I've gone into a school and I've come back a second or third time and I've finished a talk and kids now are aware And a lot of times I ask them, what kind of school do you want to be seen as? Do you want to be seen as the school that's a bully school? Or do you want to be seen as the school that's supportive and welcoming? I see a difference in the school, but part of that is that mob mentality of making sure everyone understands what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, and what are the consequences. Now, you've had a bad day. Great. If you're in a school where hate is popular, your bad day is going to get worse. But yeah. If you're in a school where the school and the administration and the staff and the students are pushing for a civil environment, then you're going to find someone who has that ear for you. You're going to find that shoulder to cry on. And your bad day may not go past that.
So,
but it's an environment that we have to make.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. And I think that's what Civility Counts is trying to get across, the fact that we have to have civil environments. And I think when we look at schools, the children need to know that they're one coming to a school. Some children don't know that they're going to school. Some people have to be taught what a school is, because when they get there, they just think it's a place of social interaction and they can just start fights, you know, or sell drugs
or be mean to people.
But let me get another point in here. So we know that the Olympics, Gabby Douglas was cyberbullied. Ridiculously. Back in 2011, there was a student at Lake Central bullied. Parents claimed that the school didn't do anything to stop it. So even there has to, even though it's deliberate, it's repeated, if it's not documented,
right,
you're still in a tough situation. I got about 2 minutes left. Cyberbullying issues in the region. Is it a problem?
Yes. One of the reasons why our task force was formed, or my position was formed, was to help with the fact that we have kids committing suicide.
Mm.
And the suicides are coming from the internet activity. They've been harassed. They've been stalked. We have kids acting out in school. We have kids who are retaliating against the entire school or entire student body because of these incidents. Yes, it is a real problem that affects our students and our bullies the rest of their lives.
Brian, Highland Schools, is there a process to eradicate cyberbullying?
I think it gets back to the environment. And, mm-hmm. and we have at Merkley Elementary, for instance, a character counts program. And you teach them from the very beginning. It's about the civility we were talking about, you know, in your character and having your character. Your question a minute ago about is it an issue in our region? It absolutely is. Students have more opportunities today than ever before.
Yeah.
10 years ago, it was MySpace.
Right.
Now it's
everything.
Snapchat, everything.
Yeah.
You know what, Bob, you get the last word. How early can a child be taught civility?
As early as we can in the schools. And that's why we have highlighted anti-bullying in this campaign. And any time we can recognize the kind of thing going on schools effectively in the paper and use all these social networks to get it out, we bring awareness and an effort.
Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon airs on Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore Public Television, and it's rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 10. The state of Indiana is partway through a record-setting cash crop harvest, but months of uneven weather conditions have put some farmers behind. The state's soybean crop is 42% harvested as of this week, about the same as on average, but the corn crop lags at just about 24%. Purdue University agronomist Bob Nielsen says wet weather earlier this year forced some farmers to plant late or replant their crops, and cool August temperatures lengthened the growing season.
You know, we obviously need good weather for the next 30 or 45 days to get both crops out, and of course farmers will focus on soybeans in the near term because it's a little more critical to get them out before they start shattering and dropping grain on the ground.
He says that corn can wait a little longer until early November. Farmers need to have it dry before harvest, which requires warm, sunny, dry weather. And Nielsen says it could cost extra to store or dry grain that is picked up early. And he says that what most farmers still prefer to harvest before the fall weather turns stormy.
As opposed to the risk of leaving it stand in the field and be subject to the winds of Mother Nature and possibly being blown over or knocked down or simply deteriorating quality.
Hoosier grains are worth $7.2 billion in the last federal farm census in 2012, or ranking Indiana as sixth in the nation. Indiana University announced yesterday that it'll invest $50 million toward efforts to fight the opioid crisis happening statewide. The initiative is a collaboration between the university, the state, as well as health experts. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports that officials say that communities across the state will play a vital role in the research.
The $50 million investment is part of Indiana University's Grand Challenges program and will be rolled out over the course of 5 years. Through the multifaceted research project, IU is partnering with Governor Eric Holcomb and health operations like IU Health to collect and analyze data, address the clinical work shortage, and work to create better policy. IU School of Nursing Dean Robin Newhouse, who will lead the large-scale effort, says perhaps the most important collaborator in the fight is the public.
So it's not just the scientists, it's not just the teachers. We need to partner with our community to understand their experience and the interventions and the support that they need in partnership with us to help address this addictions crisis.
Governor Holcomb has listed the state's opioid epidemic as one of his top priorities. The Republicans signed a bill earlier this year making it easier for local counties to create needle exchange programs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow it's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And from the Times, we'll have Ed Bierschank with us reporting on news from the city of Hammond. Joseph Pete with the business report for the region. And from the Post-Tribune, Meredith Colias will join us with an education report. We hope you can join us as well.